Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to your customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/snacky.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ.
Hey everyone, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. We all hope that you are staying safe and going out to protest and reading up and staying involved and active. If you're looking for some resources about how you can support Black Lives Matter or support Black restaurants or get involved in any way, heritageradionetwork.org has a lot of great resources on the website. Please check them out. And also take a moment to read our dear friend Kathy Airway's new article about food media and dealing with racism. It's a really, really insightful article, a great piece, and congratulations to Kathy for another great piece of writing. We are super excited to have Christy Vega, who is from Casa Vega here in Los Angeles. We talk about reopening and what it means to be a restaurant in LA and how to balance both a business and being safe. It's a really great insight, and we talk about a lot of the delicious food that they are serving. And then right from Queens, we have Glacio, who brings us some dreamy, very lyrical electronic music. It's really great, really good summer jams, and just a lot of fun. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Christy, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us at Snacky Tunes. We really appreciate knowing how busy you are balancing the restaurant, the family life. So thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, Casa Vega is an institution in Los Angeles. It's been around for over six decades, and it's not the first time the restaurant has gone through a national or regional issue that's affected the business. How is this different from you versus what you've had to go through in the history of the restaurant?
Well, this is our first pandemic we've gone through. So, you know, we've gone through pretty much everything at the restaurant. But this is definitely different because I feel like with other issues we've gone through, it seems like a lot of hard work and determination and perseverance, which I think perseverance is still key here, but can help get you through. And this is one of these things that when it all started, I remember looking at my GM being like, I don't know, hard work can't get us really through this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, hard work is tantamount in running any successful restaurant, but there has to been situations in the past where maybe you were staring down at it, it looked impossible, and then you got through it. Can you share maybe any lessons you've learned from the past in those situations where at the outset it just looked like you weren't going to make it through, and then maybe you came back even stronger?
Most definitely. I've definitely gone through those experiences, and where sometimes something seems so bleak and so horrible and that a turn of events could not be worse. What I've learned is that usually those turn of events, it's all meant to be, and that they produce a lot of silver linings, and that in the end, as bad as they are, the universe usually has a way of lifting you up even, you know, even higher than you were before. So, you know, we've had something where we had an incident a few years ago that got, you know, kind of a media storm of salacious, overblown news. And I thought, I don't know how we're ever going to really pull through this, but we did. And we persevered and we determined. And then, you know, a few years later, we're on, you know, Quentin Tarantino's new movie. So I think sometimes things have a way of working them out. And even the most disappointing events is what I've learned can have happy endings. And that's really what I feel about the pandemic that's happening now is that it's really hard and disappointing, but hopefully there'll be some restaurants and more than not that get their way through it and maybe in the end found some silver linings.
Having been through, you know, a situation like you just alluded to and other situations, is there advice that you can share with restaurateurs who maybe haven't been in the business as long as you? And what comes to mind is actions or decisions made in the moment, which you feel maybe, oh no, that may not have been the right thing, or I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have all the information. But, you know, being able to make decisions and not get held back by them and knowing that, like, situations evolve.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary making decisions for a whole business and the weight that goes with that. But I think the biggest advice I have is to go with your gut. Your gut is generally always right. And when you're doing the right thing and you combine it with your gut instinct, then I really think things always work out. I mean, the way I run Casa Vega and my family always has is doing the right thing by everybody and being the best business owner by our employees and our customers that we can. And no matter if that gets distorted for a period of time, you keep working super hard with the best ethics you can. And that generally it will reveal itself. And I think that, you know, having that right of attitude and that mindset gets you through these times.
Yeah, I mean, that's sometimes you just got to make a decision. And there are people that are relying on you to make a decision. Yeah. I know that you decided to shut down pretty much for like the first month or month and a half after the city and the state shut down the restaurants. Why did you want to pause there instead of immediately pivoting to a new form of business?
It was a tiered level decision. At first, when I heard it, part of the problem was we didn't know how long this was all happening. When they first told us it was dine-in, the kind of the stay-at-home order was going around was 2 weeks. So I thought, oh, we can limp through 2 weeks. We're horrible at food to go, or we were. Now we're great at it. But it was never something that we really were set up for or even liked to do. And our sales dropped 90%. I brought it, you know, to a skeleton crew and thought we can limp through this for a little bit. And then we did it for 3 days. And I watched the people come in and out of the restaurant as I'm watching the news. I'm watching my staff, who's generally majority of them are over 65. And not knowing what the virus was at the time and what we were dealing with, how this was going to impact my employees, were they going to get sick, serving on 10% of sales, were we going to get any customers sick? Could we pass this along to anybody? I'm a mother of four and my father's 86 and we were all working. I thought, what are we doing? Like, for a couple $100 net a day, like, I think it's just the better and safer thing to shut down until I'm confident that I can run a safe business. And, you know, there's a lot of liability when you run an operation and we serve the public and we serve elderly and we serve young people. And I just wasn't confident in what was happening. And I didn't want to find myself in a situation that I stayed open for a couple $100 a day and I was being negligent as far as safety to anybody. So that was my real decision, is that we needed to shut it down. And I was very confident that as soon as we were able to open for table service and our bar be back open, then CV would be back. And we were just going to take a pause. And it was heartbreaking and, you know, shattered my heart into pieces. It was the worst day because I felt like in a way it was giving up. And that's just something that the Vegas never do. We work really hard and constantly. But I felt it was my gut told me it was the right decision. And ethically, I felt it was the best thing for our staff.
I mean, of course. I mean, that's a decision that no restaurant has taken lightly, and especially with the unknown of the disease, but also a lack of clear federal guidelines of the best way to prevent or the messaging. That's a decision you made in the moment. Having now time to reflect on that and sort of going back to what we talked about before, now that you're a weeks and month plus away from the decision, how do you feel about that decision you made?
I feel really good about it. So I didn't really know I would. And I'm very relieved and grateful that it worked out, because it gave me some time to mourn that business a little bit and to also properly shut it down. It was an old a whole different type of concept than what we're doing. So I was able to shut that down properly, have, you know, a few weeks to kind of be sad. And then after that, I was able to kind of think, okay, if we're just going to do to go, how can we do it that we're not just living on 10% of sales? And how can we do it creatively and smart and be there for our community and at the same time our staff, and it be, you know, where we're not in the red? Because I think the one thing that nagged at me about shutting down was not being there for our neighborhood. And that Casa Vega is very important to the people in the Valley, and especially of Sherman Oaks and Studio City. And they have it as a place of comfort. So I hated that we weren't kind of in it with everybody. So that it gave me a few weeks to get remotivated and a game plan in action, a safety plan in action. And also, you know, get applying for the PPP, which then that made financial sense for us. And it all just kind of came together. And I thought, this is going to work out. And my gut told me that, you know, doing a drive-through to go could be profitable.
I mean, that's so much that goes into that decision of reopening. And I want to get into it, but I want to go back to what you just mentioned, which was the community. Because one of the great things about Casa Vega is that it has a very loyal and dedicated and longstanding clientele, extended family, depending on who you ask. And the loss of a space like Casa Vega has got to be heartbreaking for the community. But I'm sure they've been reaching out, right? I'm sure that they've been sending support or they've been sending questions. What have you heard from your clientele, and what support have you received from the community?
Well, we're back now, so it's been bonkers. But right. even we were closed, yeah, the customers would call our office. They would leave sweet messages. They would want to make sure we had customers trying to make sure that certain waiters were okay. I came to my office one day just to do some paperwork, and I found 6 people at the front door reading our sign and asking when we were going to be back open. So that it was all heartwarming. And it made me realize, you know, that's the thing about Casa Vegas. Half the time, I mean, it is my family's and it is my dad and our legacy. But at the same time, I feel like Casa Vega belongs as much to LA as it does to us.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that people talked about, was this idea of the loss of a third space, which is, it's not work, it's not home, but it's this place where you can come and meet. And for us, for my family and our friends, that's always been restaurants. You know, that's always been a place to eat. And so to lose that sense, and to not just the food or the atmosphere, but the people that you get to interact with, whether it's other guests you're seeing or the owners or your favorite waiter or chef, it's been a big loss.
Yeah, it's been a huge loss for all of us. I grew up the same way, where eating out is just not, you know, providing substance to your body. It's a breaking bread experience. It's where you bond and where you talk and where you, you know, where your family gathers and where you celebrate life's moments.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the reopening and the bonkers response. But we have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Christy Vega, owner of Casa Vega, and you reopened early May 1st for takeout. We talked a little bit about what went into that decision, but what finally pushed you over the edge, and why did you pick that date to reopen to the public in the new normal, as they say?
Well, I really wanted to be back open for Cinco de Mayo. That was my goal, is that we got to be open for Cinco de Mayo.
Of course.
And I thought that would be really fun and be there for the staff. So I wanted to do it a few days beforehand so that we could hopefully get some kinks out of the way and learn how to, you know, operate. But to be also completely transparent, we had got PPP funded that Monday evening before we opened. So I literally opened this drive-through in like 4 days.
Amazing. Wow. Talk to me about the PPP loan and how you applied for it and how you decided that you could accept it, because that's been one of the biggest issues, is how many strings are attached to that loan.
Yeah, well, I definitely have the optimist gene, so I think I definitely am a glass half full type of person. So I thought the PPP, once I figured out kind of this drive-through model, and we're so blessed to have a lot of property at Casa Vega, that I knew I could employ the people. I mean, that's the big thing about the PPP, is you basically have to revive your payroll. And it's kind of ridiculous at the 8 weeks they have it now, but I thought I could get super crazy and I could have people socially distanced and doing all sorts of jobs. I mean, you know, we don't have a full-blown restaurant that's running 11:30 a.m. to 2 a.m. every day, but I could find work for people and I could find jobs and we could socially distance and I could get everybody back on payroll. And my thought was, if I can get my guys back and my staff back, which mean the world to me, and get them paid, that's, you know, win number one. And win number two is if I can design this sort of drive-through elaborate system where then I'm using all my payroll and all I really have to make a profit on are my cost of goods with the PPP, because, you know, it's a little bit, it has some rent relief in there and some utilities. So I thought that was pretty motivating, that getting my guys back to work and then the money that I could generate from my cost of goods, I could use to spray down the liabilities that we shut down with at no notice from the city. And that hopefully when we got back to a dine-in sort of service at whatever capacity, that we were in a better economic health to make that venture and, you know, pivot in whatever direction we're going to need to. And it also sort of offsets the cost that we have with all the safety upgrades. And that's a whole other can of worms, that we're having to upgrade our entire POS system, which is a huge expense, because so it can allow reservations and contactless payment. And, you know, we have plexiglass going up and, you know, possible outdoor dining if, you know, the city permits it, which I
sure
think they will. And so there's a lot of expenditures that are coming up, and to make sure that we're doing everything safely and right. So I felt it was a pure win-win.
I mean, those are so many decisions to take into reopening. And while we can't tackle all of them, I think we would love to tackle the most delicious one first, which is the menu. Because obviously that is a completely big shift in both the theory of what you want to serve and the practicality of what you want to serve, but also really dips into this idea of the new type of restaurant experience, because there are different ways that you can now experience your favorite restaurant at home, whether it's meal kits or food to go. But how did you pick your menu, and what thought went into trying to recreate the Casa Vega experience for people who might be eating at their homes?
Well, my first thought was to pick the heavy hitters. So the things that people love the most, the things that are the number one sellers on the menu, that's what I wanted to make sure that we could get to our customers. And so, and the comfort food items, but, you know, the crispy tacos, those grilled tacos, enchiladas, taquitos, chips and salsa, and margaritas. We have, you know, like a 4 burritos. And so I figured I could make everybody pretty happy with that. You know, it's missing the moles and sort of the more authentic dishes.
Sure. Sure.
But that's really what people, I think, makes them feel like they've come to Casa Vega. You can get the house combo and you can get margaritas. And that's the most exciting part of the whole thing is sell the margaritas.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a huge shift. And while it's fun to drink margaritas, restaurant level margaritas out, there also is a really significant bottom line issue for being able to sell alcohol to go. Have you noticed that be a significant help and boost in staying in the black?
Major. Like we probably would still be in red if without it. Like it's huge. It's a game changer, and it makes the to go and the drive through profitable.
You know, everyone always talked about that if you repealed alcohol to go in any state like California, that it would just be, it would be bedlam. But I think we've seen, and maybe it's because it is a mix of the shelter at home plus the repeal, that it's something that people want and people can handle somewhat responsibly, or at least that's what I've seen in some reporting. Right. Do you think that this is something that, if things go back to normal, that will just stay?
I wish it would. I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But I hope it stays. If anyone's out there, I think it's great. I mean, I don't really see the difference of going to a liquor store and buying a bottle or coming to here and getting a margarita. You're both in your car and you both have to, both instances, you have to be a responsible citizen, an adult, and know that it should not be drunk in your car. You got to go home and, you know, have your cocktail.
Agreed.
So I hope so.
So to go back to the PPP stuff for a little bit, so, you know, not to get too deep into the weeds, but there's an 8-week allotment. It ends right now at the end of June. And I know that they're starting to talk about more federal assistance for restaurants. Even though you're in the black, even though you're up and running, do you need more federal assistance? And not just you as your specific restaurant, but the industry as a whole. Like, this got you through the first few months, but there's going to be need to be more of a safety net as this continues to stretch on.
Oh, absolutely. This is just a little Band-Aid to get us through these next, like you said, like this next month or so, because we would be fully in the red with all the payroll. So that, you know, once you add the payroll in there, it's, you just can't survive it. And so the definitely the restaurants, it's a totally different business than any other business, and they need massive support, because even when we get to reopen, I had some firemen here yesterday. I mean, word on the street is it's, you know, it's 25% capacity, and my rent doesn't change 25%, and all my expenditures they don't go down 25%. So the way, you know, restaurants are massively expensive to run, and people don't always understand the expenses that we have. We really, restaurateurs, we run on fumes, and it's like cents that we make. But when you generate a lot of cents, it works. And, you know, when Casa Vega is at full throttle, it's a profitable, good, stable business. But once it starts to peter out or sales aren't all there, then the ship goes sideways. So I think that I could say that for most restaurants is that it works when every table's full. And when you're doing your max capacity is when it works. When it's not, you die. So if the government's going to mandate that we be at, you know, 75% less business, how could we survive?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully people are starting to see the social and economic impact of restaurants. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I vastly underestimated how much independent restaurants contribute to the national GDP and then also the national workforce. Yeah. So hopefully they're going to see that if those restaurants go away, it's not just the economy that goes down, but also the social infrastructure, because so many restaurants have been seen as a guiding light for certain areas and neighborhoods have developed around a popular restaurant.
No, you're totally right. It creates better home value. You know, it's also where people go celebrate. You generally don't go to big chain restaurants for your celebrations in life. You know, you're not going to, and all the big, you know, sort of conglomerate restaurants, they're going fast service. And so, you know, unless we want a landscape full of quick serve restaurants only, and we're going to lose all the places where you go for anniversaries and, you know, where communities gather for memorials. And we've had weddings and memorials and reunions and anniversaries and birthdays. And it's restaurants are part of the community in more ways than just serving food.
Yeah. And, you know, as those new regulations start to unfold, I mean, I read some of the early stuff, which was stay in your car, order from your car, go and eat your food and leave. And I'm just like, that's not why I go to a restaurant. Like I'd rather just pick it up to go if that's what it's going to be. But hopefully, you know, if the curve stays down and they start allowing outdoor eating for people with patios, maybe, you know, maybe people start coming back. I don't think it goes without saying, but safety of everyone has to come first.
It does. I do think sometimes we can get lost in so many regulations that I don't even know what they're serving at this point. And, right. and it that's certainly in harm's ways with the customers trying to feel like we're controlling them. But I agree. It's not the experience people want. And I think outdoor dining will be huge to kind of offset that, because then we can create spaces that are still fun and relaxing to go to, where you don't feel, you know, like you're practically in a hospital trying to eat. But the regulations, they're a lot. And, you know, it's funny. I've heard some restaurateurs, such as Danny Meyer, say, well, I'm not even going to open my places until I can provide, you know, the sort of dining experience I want to, where people aren't in masks and gloves. And it's a little disappointing to hear him say that, because yeah. I get it. We all wish we were sitting on Wall Street money and could have that luxury. Huh. But most independent restaurateurs have to get back out there and do whatever they can to save their business right now.
Well, I think that brings up a good point, is what is the future of a restaurant going to look like? And I don't know if those behemoth restaurants that have C-level people who are running the corporation of it are going to be able to reopen. I just don't know if they don't have that revenue. Forget just what you have with inside the four walls of the restaurant, of rent and ingredients and healthcare and payroll and things like that. But if all of a sudden you have to support all these people who are sitting in an office somewhere, what is that path forward? I don't know if there is one in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I don't know. I just hope that there has been some great ruckus made by Tom Colicchio and some other amazing restaurateurs of trying to educate the people in the government. The restaurants need a mass amount of help if people want us here when it's over.
Yeah. So I want to bring it back to what you mentioned a little bit at the top of our conversation, which is the silver lining. Because now we are a couple months in, you're open, the people are going bonkers for the food once again. But what has been an unexpected silver lining through this whole experience, something that can offer a little bit of hope to people who might not be as far down in the reopening process as you are right now?
Well, definitely the silver lining was success, was that, you know, we were able to generate a profit in a time where it just seems almost impossible. And the silver lining that the business, you know, no matter what happens, we'll be okay. And whether that silver lining is just, you know, the good luck charm that Casa Vega's always had is still intact, or as myself as an operator, I know that if I need to pivot on a moment's notice and do a complete new business model out of my brand, I have the capacity to do it. And that is immensely a huge silver lining for myself, knowing that, you know, whatever comes up, I can continue to put one foot in front of the other and survive.
Amazing. Well, congratulations to you and the team. If people want to get in touch or order or just follow along with what you're doing, where can they go?
So to order, you can call us at 818-788-4868, or you can go onto our website at CasaVega.com and order. And we also have Instagram at Casa Vega Restaurant, and I have one, Christy Vega Official. And we're pretty transparent about what's happening here, and we want Los Angeles to know that we're fighting for our business to be here for another 60 years.
Amazing. Well, congratulations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be through the drive-thru very soon with some margaritas to go to enjoy safely at home, or maybe the backyard. Maybe the backyard. Yeah.
Maybe the backyard. Have a Tarantino in your backyard.
Oh my God. It's almost the weekend, so we can't wait. Well, listen, we have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Square. You might know Square from their little white card readers, but Square has a lot more tools that can help businesses, especially now that they're having to figure out how to safely reopen and make things work in this new normal. So many are stepping up to the challenge, like Fifth Hammer Brewing in Long Island City. To adapt, Fifth Hammer's co-owner Mary Izette created a Square online store so customers could browse available beers, build an order, and safely pick up cans from the tap room.
I was able to set up our online store within 24 hours of moving to a to-go model.
The Square online store allowed Fifth Hammer to keep beer production going, serve their local customers, and retain employees.
It's also very easy to train your staff on. They will be able to receive, fulfill, and provide your customers with a contactless pickup in no time.
If you're a business owner, Square wants you to know it has tools that can help you shift your business, like Fifth Hammer is doing. No matter if you're brewing beer, baking bread, or mixing to-go cocktails, you can start taking online orders in minutes with pickup and delivery. And if you're selling in person, Square can help you accept contactless payments. All these tools work together and they're all in one place. You just need a Square account to get started. See all the ways Square can help your business right now by visiting square.com/go/snacky.
Hello, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Glacio here from Queens, New York. Welcome. Welcome to the show and thank you for reaching out to us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. I've been a fan for a while and happy to be on.
Oh, well, we are happy to hear from you and talk to you about the upcoming record and your creative process. You know, speaking of the creative process, the last few months and especially the few weeks have been a really unique time in America and the world. Something that obviously we will never forget and hopefully we'll never live through again. But as an artist, how have you processed everything and what has inspired you? And of what's inspired you, have you put that into your art?
Yeah. So I think when it comes to like how I absorb the world around me and try to reproduce it in a way that's artistic, I think I usually need some time to process like all of us do and to think of ways that talk about the subject in a way that's tasteful and then also true to my identity. I think that's super, super important. I'm always afraid. I've always been very nervous about exploiting situations for artistic gain, such as when COVID-19 started rising in March. I was on Hype Machine and I literally saw a band called COVID-19. And you know, that being the extreme version of doing something the wrong way. So I definitely like taking time to think and pause and document how it affects me, which feels genuine. And I think there are lots of different people that could relate to that experience. And just being honest about how you live through things will eventually be relatable to someone. So I'm sort of really still absorbing everything. And I'm curious to know how this impacts music that people release next year. If we come out of this and it was a sort of momentary chapter, will music scenes evolve that are sort of fun and chaotic? Like I sometimes think about the New York music scene after 9/11, from what I've read about it and the kinds of bands that erupted out of the electroclash scene. And, I don't know if you've read Meet Me in the Bathroom, but it is,
No, I've read it, but I was also there.
A little bit older.
It was such a visceral reaction of what was going on, and you could see that people had processed that and turned that into art. And you know, with COVID-19 and now the Black Lives Matter protests, I think you're going to see a lot more explosive and politically driven and art that I think you're going to get away from maybe a little bit of the pop stuff and see more stuff that has thought and purpose behind it.
Yeah. Something that's less escapist than maybe previous moments I'm imagining as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because in digging into your music and the writings on your music, what you talked about it is that you really think that the type of music, this electric music, electronic music you make, is a really good type of music for storytelling, which when you think of electronic music, or especially where it's sort of gone in the last few years, it's not really a place you go for stories.
Yeah.
But why do you feel that the music you make and the this bedrock of sounds is really good for telling a narrative?
I think that the way electronic music has been consumed is all, it's been very visceral for the most part. And I think there's something fun there. There's a lot of room to play. There's something fun you can do by introducing something viscerally, but then adding layers to it that from a cerebral level, you know, you respond to differently. I think I've always just, I grew up as a singer-songwriter before I started producing. And I was, you know, when I was 16, I was going to the coffee houses and the open mics and just like listening to every Paul Simon solo record, like back to front. And I think when I started getting into dance music, I always had this image of if like Neil Young made a record on the moon, which he kind of did with Transformer Man, but something that could have been a bit more like something a bit more sweeter. I like the idea of making electronic music that feels sweet and lullaby like, and that's always been of interest to me. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but it definitely, like, there's imagery that I've always thought of when I think about making the music I make.
Well, to tie it back to what we talked about in the first section, there sometimes could be a vapidness with electronic music where it is just tracing a trend and not really saying anything or distilling complex emotions and thoughts into one or two repetitive lines, whose ultimate goal may not be the actual spreading of story or personality or thought. But you know, you have a lot of introspective lyrics, and I think when you tie those with the genre of music, it does create something new. And I think something that's probably going to be an easier shift in processing the type of current events into your art than maybe what some other people might be dealing with the music they make.
Yeah, I think so too. I've always liked the irony of like making something that was meant for a roof deck part, like a rooftop party, but having something that lyrically suggests introspection, an introspective experience. It's always been, I've always liked that sort of juxtaposition. And that's sort of, what drives me with this project, at least.
I love it. Well, listen, let's get into a song. I believe Weight of the World Part 2 is your first track.
Yes, that's right.
And what's the story behind it?
I wrote this, it was 2017, and I think it was late summer. I was basically wanting to talk about things that were, the world felt like a huge mess back then, which was like, compared to now, I mean, it's silly to say, but I basically wanted to write a song that was a social commentary on political events and things around me, and I felt really overwhelmed by the news. So that was Weight of the World 2.
Awesome. Well, here we go. Glacio live on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
On and on, feel like a million burning suns, flickering heartbeats pump at once. Now it's one more second till midnight, then I'm done. The weight of the world goes on and on, with fractured commotion, bruising sun. I feel it beneath my skin at dawn. Now it's one more second of midnight, then I'm gone. I'm gone where my heart beats on the blade, and I'm gone where the river burns through the lake. When I fall, I hope I fall wide awake, and I know I'll be making all the same mistakes without you. Without you. Without you. Without you. Visions are louder on the cruise. Faithful companions always lose. Lost in a father's drinking blues. I can't seem to make up my mind now, and it's so hard to choose. The frame of the world burns on and on, combusting and breathing simple songs with natural remedies and songs. You hear them howling at midnight, and they won't be up for long. I'm gone when my heart beats on the blade, and I'm gone where the river burns through the lake. When I fall, I hope I fall wide awake, and I know I'll be making all the same mistakes without you. Forever, one shot to the moment dies. Maybe I'm a heart that can last forever. One shot to the moment dies. Maybe I'm a heart that can last forever. One shot to the moment dies. Maybe I'm a heart that can wait without you. Without you. Yeah.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Glacio on with us. Loved that first track that you played, so thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for playing it.
I want to talk about the fact that you were born in the UAE and you eventually wound up in Central California, because I'm always interested about American culture and American music and how it's perceived by the rest of the world, but more importantly, how it's then filtered into different singers, songwriters, and artists, because you mentioned that as a teenager, you started making your own music. So how did you see that music, that culture, and how did it inspire you?
Yeah, so basically, we were a small community of expats when we were living there, and when my parents moved there in the late 80s. And it was, my mom's from Dublin, and she's the musical person in the family. She went to school and she was a choral singer at Trinity College, and she sang like backups with Enya and stuff like that with her choir. So it was like, I remember being born, and then on all the family videos, I'm like crawling to Enya, which is pretty intense. And honestly, it's great music to learn how to walk to. I mean, not that I remember, but I, from this age looking back. So everything that I consumed musically was through her and through like just a lot of UK new wave stuff, like Prefab Sprout, New Order, Enya, and like Sting. So basically there wasn't much music. There was no music scene in the UAE ever, when I was there, at least that I knew of. But when I grew older, Virgin Megastore opened, and that was like, you know, I'd go and buy CDs. And that was the only place to go buy music that I knew of. And, because of that, you basically got the best of the best. You wouldn't even find like Yola Tengo over there or someone that, like, you wouldn't find much indie music. So it would be a lot of older established singer-songwriters or 50 Cent and Shania Twain. So my elementary school experience was soundtracked by a lot of that. But then basically before I moved, I was becoming a huge Paul Simon fan and Neil Young fan. And that was basically my gateway. And Pet Sounds. It's funny. It's just weird to think I bought Pet Sounds in the Middle East because I associate the Beach Boys so much with sand dunes, which is, I guess, not far off from the beach, but it's a different biome. So it's like
it's a different sand vibe, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. the problem with, I mean, I haven't been back to the United Arab Emirates in years, and I think a lot of people that grew up there could say the same thing. There's nothing really homey about growing up there because everything changes, everyone moves away, and people are there pretty much temporarily, like we were. And because of that, it just feels, I mean, I don't mean to be insulting to anyone that's listening, but at least from my perspective, it felt vapid for when I was there, in the sense that I think a Top Man is over my childhood bedroom right now, like a Top Shop. I think I walked into the mall and I tried to figure out where my bed was, and I did it as a joke, but I thought it was kind of funny. I like walked into Top Man, in the men's section,
and that's where I used to sleep, right near the blazers and the sweaters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in the discount rack.
Yeah. Now I know that you currently live in Queens, and the Siren Song of New York pulled you there in the early 2000s, 2011, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, if you're into music, New York is a great place to go. So I assume that that's one of the reasons why that drew you there. But what drew you to New York culturally? And, you know, what drew you to Queens eventually?
When I was in high school in California, I was looking into schools, and I wanted to get into Berkeley, Boston originally, like anyone that wants to pursue music. I didn't get in there, but I got into a school at NYU, Clive Davis opened up like back in the mid 2000s or so. And it was a music production program, and it also gave you classes on business and like journalism and stuff like that. And it seemed really exciting. And that was obviously one reason. It was the only school I got into. And then New York in itself has just always been, I mean, it's huge. Like, it's always inspired. One of the first movies I ever remember seeing was Escape from New York. And I mean, I think, a lot of the music I grew up listening to came out of New York, and I'm not really a fan of LA and cars and traffic. I like the ability to find a bottle of water quickly if I need one. I think it's a helpful city for that. And that was basically it. I absolutely love the city, and it's been heartbreaking even now leaving it. It always hurts me to leave, you know?
I love it. I mean, if you ever live in New York, you know, I find that it's such an inspiring city.
It is. And it's just there are just so many different neighborhoods that feel similar, but just have a completely different tone. And I love everything. I love having I even love having a crisis in New York. Like I would not want to have the same crisis anywhere else. I should be careful with that language, but
yeah,
like a micro crisis, something that, you know, wouldn't bother you the next day, but that temporarily upsets you. It's a wonderful city. I'm a big walker as well. And I write a lot of the music I write when I'm walking. So, I don't think I could do that as much in a car. I have really bad ideas when I'm in a car. everything is just really daft. So.
Yeah. Well, let's hear another track. I believe the next one is Almost Forgot How to Play Guitar. What is the story behind that one?
My dad, like many parents, like just doesn't like my newer music as much as my older music, because there's a sentimental value to what I first came up with when I was 16, and also taste. So he was like, you should start playing guitar more, because that was my first instrument. And he says that in a sweet way. It's not like in a degrading way. I felt like I almost did forget how to play guitar. And it was sort of, the song's on my upcoming album. It hasn't actually been released yet. And I think I wrote it lying down, and it was the first song I had written on a guitar in about 7 years. It has a little like waltzy pattern to it that's different from the rest of the songs in the album.
Well, here we go. Blasio on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Almost forgot.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that track. And I know you mentioned it's on your upcoming album, but I wanted to ask you, given everything that's going on in the world right now, what is your thought about releasing an album that you've written either, I assume, before or finishing up before the pandemic and everything that's been going on with Black Lives Matters in the last few weeks? And do you re-examine what you wrote, or do you think about putting out the album? What's your mindset?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was just on the phone with several people working with me on the release and talking about it and trying to figure out a plan. I felt both through the Black Lives Matter movement in the past 2 weeks and COVID, a little uneasy about self-promoting music, and lots of my friends feel the same way. So I wrote the album a year and a half ago and started writing it, and started planning the release dates back in October. My view is I'm still deciding. There's a chance that I might not release the album. I mean, there's a chance I might push it back a little bit. And if not, if I'm going to release it, there's definitely going to be a charitable aspect to the album. There are definitely organizations that I'm looking at that I would want to be putting the money directly towards to help in any way I can with what's going on. There are lots of different things. I do believe that Black voices should be the focal point right now and should be having full access to social media space to get the message out. And that's something that I'm trying to weigh the options here to make sure that I don't fill the ether with noise that can come out at a later time.
Mm. No, I think that stepping aside to make space for voices is an important thought to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you talk about this album and how it's about accepting fragility. And that seems like a really important message for people to consider today about how things can be fragile and how your mindset or your person might be fragile. But what does it mean to you?
Yeah, so when I started writing the album, the songs were very much about a disintegrating friendship, basically the loss of a soulmate and learning to be individual and independent again, which doesn't really have a direct relationship with what's happening in the world right now. That being said, a lot of people that I've sent it to have found their own meaning in it and find the songs to be sort of soulful and almost a little spiritual. That's not my words. That's other people's language. And they've convinced me that maybe it's not a bad thing to have out in the world. It's a positive piece of music. It's not something that's insensitive to the situations going on around. And I would definitely be careful about the kind of music I'd be releasing, given the context of what's going on.
Yes, I agree. Well, I appreciate you making the time for us, and thank you for sharing your thoughts, especially as we all sort of process our own thoughts. And I appreciate you sharing some of them with us. If people want to follow along or check you out online, where can they go?
They can find me at Glacio Music, one word. And then on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere they like to listen to music the most. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We have one last song from you, Make No Mistake. What's the story behind this one?
I wrote this song basically at the end of 2018 when my mental health wasn't at its best and I was just having issues leaving the house and, you know, to do day-to-day tasks were just kind of not easier than they used to be. And this came out, this has been the latest single. It came out 2 weeks ago, and it, you know, I couldn't suspend the release, but it took place right before the murder of George Floyd. So I haven't really been promoting this one, but it was just a very strange time as well to be. The lyrics sort of also reflect, weirdly kind of reflect the situation with COVID and the world outside as well. So this was sort of an awkward time to accidentally have this come out around then. But it's a long song. It's the longest. It's like the danciest song on the album, I think.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you taking the time and sharing your music with us. Here we go. Make no mistake. On Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. We will see you next time.
I'll fight the wars outside and pray. Make no mistake. My heart can't beat without you. I'll shine a light inside my face. Oh, make no mistake. Every little thing about you makes me wanna go back. Mama, life could only get much harder. You know I'm gonna go on out tonight. No, I'm gonna go on out tonight. And lover, life could only get much harder. No, I'm gonna go back out tonight.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.